Do you all schedule?
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Alrighty then. So, I unfortunately do not have a report for you from the big climate rally that was supposed to be held on Friday. I was going to go, but I didn't really feel great about it. And the person I was going to go with didn't really feel great about it either, and so neither of us ended up going. And maybe that was a good thing after all, because in Berlin, now of course I'm in Munich, and things are a little different in Munich than they are in Berlin, but in Berlin, a Nuclearia member, a pro-nuclear activist in Germany, Britta Augustin, was attacked at the big climate rally they were having there. I'm going to post a link to that in com, just so you can read it for yourself. Let's see. You know, I like to, you know, sort of show up, and in fact, I've got these, I made up these flyers that I think are pretty good flyers that say, Wer sagt, alles fürs Klima, aber keine Atomkraft, bitte, spricht mit gespaltener Zunge. Whoever says, oh yes, anything for the climate, we must do everything for the climate, but none of that nasty atomic power, please, speaks with a forked tongue. And of course, the joke, such as it is that the word gespaltener is derived from the verb spaltung, which is also used in Kernspaltung, meaning nuclear fission. I've been spat on, but that's as bad as it's gotten. Like I say, I do like to show up, because I like to remind people that, hey, you know, you talk a lot about this, but you don't want to use any effective solutions. You say this is the most important issue of our time, and we insist on only using solutions that will not solve it. You know, we insist that we must not use the most effective tool that we have. And of course, nobody wants to be told that, right? They get angry when you tell them that. Well, oh, well, you know, what do I care? People can be angry all the time if they want. But seriously, though, I mean, if you will listen to the archive of yesterday's show that I did, I was, again, reading various bits and bobs of nuclear energy-related publications, and I came across a quote from 1958. The columnist in Nuclear Power magazine mentioning that the nuclear power might ultimately have an effect on the climate by reducing the amount of carbon dioxide that was emitted by burning fossil fuels. And he says, of course, this is such a slow process that we'll probably never notice it. Oh, well. But that's sort of the depressing thing is that you look look at the 1957 volumes, and they have the British government's announcement of their 6,000 megawatt nuclear power program, which was announced on the same day that, or within one or two days of when gasoline rationing and heating oil rationing started in Britain because of the Suez Crisis. And so everybody was saying, oh yeah, maybe fossil fuels aren't something we should rely on so heavily. Maybe we should look at this alternative. And then within a year, right, that position was being backed off of. Yeah, 19 stations and 6,000 megawatts. Anyway, was the initial program, which didn't that. The idea was that by like 1970, 40% of Britain's electricity, basically the whole base load, would be served by nuclear fission plants, meaning that, you know, coal would wind up being relegated to the variable load period. Anyway, it was a great program, but the thing was that a lot of people looked at it and said, well, maybe that won't work quite the way we expect. There's a very good article, in fact, in Nuclear Power Magazine questioning the assumptions behind the official program, and it was opinions like that which really carried the day, and it turned out, however, that things went the other way entirely. So there was a lot of question, for example, as to whether fuel burnups of 3 megawatt days of heat per kilogram of uranium fuel could be achieved. No one was really sure. You have to understand that the orders for the commercial power stations began quite soon after Calder Hall started up. Calder Hall, which is the first power-producing gas graphite reactor in the world. It was operated initially as a plutonium producer, which meant you took the fuel slugs out of the reactor fairly early in the irradiation cycle. So they didn't provide a lot of good evidence as to how the fuel slugs would last under longer irradiation. So people said, well, you know, yeah, we're expecting these plants to last 20 years, but if they don't, they're going to be a bad investment. And we're expecting these fuel slugs to reach 3 megawatt days per kilogram of irradiation, but if they don't, fuel cycle costs are going to be real high. And we can't really predict this right at the moment, so we're really overcommitted. As it turns out, it was completely the opposite. They knew they really wanted to reach 3 megawatt days per kilogram. By the mid-70s, they were averaging 5.5. And while the stations were expected, they were built on the basis of lasting 20 or 25 years, they lasted 40. So, as it turns out, these nuclear power stations that were commissioned in the late 50s, early 60s, were actually a much better investment than the people who made the decision to build them and buy them even knew. And that's sort of a sad thing, because if they had gone on, right, if they had gone on building them, they would have been in a much better position. Because here's the thing. Britain, you know, it kept happening. You know, shortly after the Suez Crisis, you know, the French discovered big supplies of oil and gas in French-controlled West Africa, and they said, oh, well, we've got plenty of fossil fuels. We don't have to worry so much. We can slow walk our nuclear power program. We're going to keep developing it, but we're not going to go so hard for it because we're really not sure. Oddly enough, the French experience with gas graphite reactors was not nearly as good as the British experience, despite very close similarities. Just one of those odd things. Anyway, but after the 1973 oil price shocks, they said, holy fnord, we've really got to do something now. And so they decided to go for nuclear power. And at that time, the nuclear power plant design with the best track record was the American pressurized water reactor. And so they just started building those in large volumes. Bertrand Goldschmidt, who was the head of the French Nuclear Energy Agency at the time, has said in his book, The Atomic Complex, essentially that if they'd had another couple of years to make the decision, judging by Pickering in Ontario, they probably would have built CANDU instead, which would have allowed them to use natural uranium rather than enriched uranium, which would have been a big advantage. Anyway, but I'm getting off my point, whatever my point actually is. Essentially that people made really great plans which would have resulted in a very different world from the one we live in, and then didn't stick with it. Britain went back to using coal, and then there were the big North Sea gas strikes, and Britain began burning gas. Now, of course, if they had built nuclear power plants on the scale originally envisioned, would they have drilled for gas? Certainly. But they probably would have sold a lot more of it overseas instead of burning it domestically, which would have put the British economy in a much stronger position. And of course, the British economy has been in a chronically weak position, you know, since the end of the Second World War, if not the end of the First World War. To some extent, that's because of extremely bad management. For example, at the end of the First World War, with the big rush to demobilize and so on, the British government sold off a bunch of stuff as surplus, and to the great detriment of the industries that had tooled up to produce it. So, for example, their airplanes were made of wood covered with cloth, and the linen industry in Ireland, the Belfast linen industry, had tooled up to produce immense volumes of linen for covering airplanes. And then, at the end of the war, the British government auctioned off all of that linen in a very short period of time, which, of course, killed the Belfast linen industry, right? Because they've gone into serious debt to expand their production plants so that they can produce all this linen. And then not only do they cease getting orders, but all of this stuff gets dumped on the market and kills their orders for a couple of years, which really sent them into a, you know, financial crisis from which I don't think they ever really recovered. So, I don't know, that may be a meaningless historical sidelight, and I may just be babbling. But one of the things that I found in the reports of the 1979 Combination European Nuclear Congress and Foratom meeting was a fascinating discussion by a fellow by the name of Chauncey Starr, who was early on head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Later on, he was head of the Electric Power Research Institute. Anyway, talking about energy and about how Greens and people like that see energy use, and about how economists see energy use. And he pointed out what I think is really, really important to think about, that the way that economists analyze things is generally on a marginal basis. In other words, they look at the cost and the benefit of the last unit of something produced or consumed. And this applies to energy, among other things. And he says that you see this economist's mindset in the person who lives in a wealthy country and looks at energy use and says, oh yeah, you could cut back massively on your energy use. Nobody has to use this much energy. We use way too much energy. Because he's looking at the last unit of energy consumed, which undoubtedly is produced at the highest price and is probably used on something frivolous. He doesn't look at his whole way of life, right? I mean, again, my friend here in Munich went down to the subway station near here, where a couple of the political parties had set up their stands today, and he argued with some of the Greens for a while and came back and told me they were completely detached from reality. He said, you know, there was this guy who kept saying, but we just have to use a lot less energy. We just have to use a lot less energy. And it's just, it doesn't work that way. Even if you were to stop using electricity and gas and heating oil and all those things in your home right now today, that would still account for only a half to a third of your energy footprint, as it were, because you have to remember that there's the industries in your country, the industries outside your country, the, you know, public buildings, you know, your pro rata share of public buildings and street lights and all those things, water treatment plants that provide you with, you know, clean, fresh water every time you open the tap. These are all energy consuming things. And if you think you'd be better off without them, well, you've got a hole in your head, buddy. But so that's, you know, that to me is a very important consideration, that many people say, oh, we could do with using much less energy, and they don't actually understand how energy is used or what it's used for. So here's a fun one, because I like to go and, you know, for example, you can look at the key world statistics published by the International Energy Agency, very useful useful compilation of information. And you can look at who uses the most energy. And this is the fun thing, because you'll see you'll see people talking about, I saw somebody talking about Iceland, and they said, wow, you look at Iceland, you know, Iceland, they've got geothermal energy, right? And so they, you know, they use it to melt snow and things like this. Anyway, I found it kind of interesting because, yeah, Iceland. This is really interesting for me. Maybe not for you, but you know, you're listening to this, so maybe it's interesting to you. So the IEA Key World Statistics, I've got selected indicators for 2018 pulled up. Now, they quote total primary energy supply in tons of oil equivalent, which is a kind of a weird unit, difficult to cope with. But let's just put it this way. United States of America, tons of consumes per head of population 6.81 tons of oil equivalent, right, per American. 0.11 ton oil equivalent per 1,000 U.S. dollars GDP. That's not as important. But 6.81 tons of oil equivalent per head of population, 13,098 kilowatt hours of electricity per head of population. Okay, I want you to fix that in your mind because that is a really high number. So let's look at somebody who consumes more electricity than the United States. Let's look at Sweden. Sweden just edges out the United States, 13,331 as opposed to 13,098. On the other hand, their total energy supply per head of population is only, 4.89. Now, let's go up here and look at Norway. Norway, 24,047 kilowatt hours per head of population, but only 5.33 tons oil equivalent energy supply per head of population. Again, that's partly because they're heavily in hydro. And hydro, instead of having to burn 2.5 to 3 units of fuel to make 1 unit of electricity, you just get 1 unit of electricity out. That's how it's accounted for. You could account for it by multiplying the electricity figures by 2.5 to 3, but they don't, I think, in this compilation. I don't think that they do that. Actually, it says here, energy equivalent of nuclear is assumes 33%, but for hydro is, it just assumes direct 1-to-1. Okay. But we go up a little further, and we go to Iceland. And this is great. Iceland. Electric consumption per head of population, 54,605 kilowatt hours, which is more than 4 times the U.S. figure, considerably more than twice the Norwegian figure. Total energy supply per head of population, 17.4 tons of oil equivalent, which is not quite 3 times, but certainly 2.5 times the U.S. figure. Holy cow, that's an enormous amount of energy. Now, they don't use it all in their homes, obviously. A great deal of that energy is used for things like smelting aluminium, energy-intensive primary industries. But I've been thinking about this because I think it's thought about in the wrong way. Again, this is real, you know, this is real stuff, okay? This is really important to think about things in the right way. If you say, oh, well, you shouldn't use that much energy, well, how about turning it around on its head? Imagine that every northern country used energy at the rate that Iceland does, or electricity. Let's just say electricity, used electricity at the rate that Iceland does. Well, of course, every northern country couldn't use electricity at the rate that Iceland does because Iceland has more hydro capacity per head of population than any country in the world. They have a colossal amount of hydro. It's ludicrous. And a relatively small population. There's only 300,000 people in the entire country. So, you know, they can get away with it, right? In order for Sweden or Norway, let's say Norway, right? Norway's already, you know, halfway there almost, right? In order for Norway to consume that much electricity per head of population, they'd have to build a whole bunch of nuclear power plants, presumably breeder reactors, presumably working on thorium, because you know what they got in Norway? Thorium! Who would have thought? Anyway, and in fact, there have been, you know, programs for nuclear energy in Norway for a very long time. Norway, in fact, was the first non-nuclear weapons country, I guess you'd say, to have a nuclear energy program. That Norway started building a heavy water moderated research reactor shortly after the Second World War. because they had heavy water. What they didn't have was any uranium. But when they got the thing finished, the ambassador from the Netherlands sidled up and said, "So, hey, my country bought a bunch of uranium just before the Second World War and successfully hid it from the Nazis, and I wonder if you would be interested in obtaining some of this uranium to run your nuclear reactor." And Norway said, "Oh, yeah, that sounds really cool." And so the Norwegians had a nuclear reactor before practically anybody except the U.S., the Soviet Union, Great Britain, maybe France. Okay, so Norway has never officially had a nuclear power reactor, except that it had a nuclear power reactor for a good half century. 60 years, in fact, more like. Yeah, 60 years. And now, how is that possible? Well, the answer is there was something called the Halden Experimental Reactor. Halden, a boiling water, boiling heavy water pressure vessel reactor, which was used for a whole variety of scientific investigations. And although it never produced electricity, it was never fitted up to produce electricity, it was fitted up with a heat exchanger. It was built inside a cavern blasted into a mountain. Now, if you've ever been to Norway, you know that's pretty much all they have is mountains. And the other thing that they have on the mountains in Norway is trees, which means they've got a big paper industry. And the Halden reactor, off and on, supplied large quantities of steam to a nearby paper mill. In fact, it was built on the property of the paper mill. So they actually did supply commercial energy, although it never supplied electricity. When the Halden reactor finally shut down a couple of years ago, like I say, after 60 years almost of operation, the Norwegian anti-nuclear group Bellona trumpeted, "This is a great victory for the environment!" To which my response was, "In what way?" You know, and their thing was, "It's contributed 10 cubic meters of the 17 cubic meters of spent of nuclear waste, high-level nuclear waste in Norway." To which my response was, "Yeah, 17 cubic meters, that sounds really hard to manage. So you have a thing on your website where you're saying that you support carbon capture and storage as a future energy solution. Now you're talking about millions of cubic meters, not over the course of 60 years, but over the course of, like, millions of cubic meters a month, millions of cubic meters possibly a day of wastes, which are, of course, naturally in a gaseous form, and they're highly acidic and would be really difficult to dispose of. How exactly you're going to dispose of those is unclear." Okay, great fun. So we've had a request from COM here to give you the statistics for China. So, People's Republic of China, tons of oil equivalent per head of population, 2.30 kilowatt hours of electricity per head of population, 4906. All right. Hong Kong, China, primary energy supply for head of population, 1.9. Well, that's interesting. That's substantially less than for the mainland as a whole, but electric consumption per capita, kilowatt hours, 6299. Which is, you know, it's not 50% higher, but it's substantially higher. And then I have to go down here some distance to what's officially labeled as Chinese Taipei, although it's alphabetized as Taiwan. Total energy supply per head of population, 4.85 tons oil equivalent. Electric consumption per head of population, 11,227 kilowatt hours, which is close to the U.S. figure. Who else has electric consumption that high? Well, the United Arab Emirates, 13,242. That's an example. They burn a lot of their own gas, obviously. They burn it to make electricity, and they use that electricity to run air conditioners. Except, of course, if you've been following the news, you know that they now have nuclear power plants. And those nuclear power plants, which they bought from South Korea, are expected to basically make back the money they spent on them in 18 months or so, because it means they can sell the gas instead of burning it. Who else is on the list here? Kuwait, 15,402 kilowatt hours per person. Again, 8.22 tons oil equivalent primary energy supply, and it's pretty much all oil. But yeah, that's so interesting. Maybe I'm being slightly snide. But yeah, so, you know, Qatar, 16,580, 15.6 tons oil equivalent, 16,580 kilowatt hours per person per year. But Korea, oddly enough, Korea is only filed under Korea here, that there's no entry that I can... North Korea, bizarrely, is filed under DPR Korea and is alphabetized that way. DPR Korea, 0.56 tons oil equivalent per head of population, which is less than one-tenth of the U.S. value. 509 kilowatt-hours electricity per head of population, which is pathetically small. That's, remember, as compared to 13,000 for the U.S. But let's give a fair comparison, right? DPR Korea, 0.56 tons oil equivalent, 509 kilowatt-hours. Regular Korea, regular flavor Korea, 5.47 tons oil equivalent, so not quite 10 times, 11,082 kilowatt-hours. So that is slightly more, well, that's around, what, 20 times? In fact, it's more like 22 times. Okay. So that's an interesting bit of data there, right? But again, I just want to encourage you, anytime anyone says, you know, I mean, there's the people who say we must do more with less. Well, it's to be pointed out that, to a great extent, we have increased energy efficiency greatly. But there is something called Jevons paradox. When you increase the efficiency with which you use energy, by implication, you increase the benefit that you get from using each additional unit of energy, which means you, to some extent, create an incentive to use more energy, not less, because you're using it more efficiently. And this is one reason why wealthy countries, you know, right up until the 1980s, essentially, wealthy countries produced a lot of goods and sold them to poor countries. Now we have the opposite situation, where China, where energy is used quite inefficiently, is manufacturing goods to sell them to the rest of the world. And why is this? You know, how did this bizarre situation come about? Well, to some extent, it has to do with international politics and international finance and the bizarre ideas of people who attend the Harvard Business School. But it's also possible to say, if you look at world energy projections for, you know, from the 1970s, for example, they project a certain growth in world energy demand, and then they, you know, show, well, this is the energy demand we expect in the United States in the year 2000 or 2025. This is the energy demand we expect in Europe and so on. And the figures, the actual figures for the U.S. or Europe or wherever, are considerably lower today than what was projected. Okay, and your environmentalists will say, yay, energy conservation, we're using less energy. But then you look at the global figures, and it turns out the global aggregate figures aren't much different from the projections. In other words, it wasn't energy conservation at all. It's just that the U.S. and Europe, which did not build those nuclear power plants, for example, the 75 nuclear power plants that Germany was expecting to build, or at least under Helmut Schmidt's government, Germany was talking about building, 75 gigawatts of nuclear electricity. Well, as it turns out, what happened was that the energy-using primary industries, to a great extent, moved elsewhere. They moved to China, to a great extent, where the energy needs were supplied, instead of being supplied by environmentally benign nuclear energy, because we have to repeat that by any objective measure, the harm per terawatt hour or whatever the value you want to use is, done by nuclear energy production is much, much smaller than for other energy sources. But instead it's being met by coal mined in North China, which is a very, very rich coal province. And you have people going into the ground and digging out coal, and a surprisingly large number of them never coming up again. I guess it was about 10 years ago, I was looking at the official statistic was something like 12,000 fatalities in the course of a year in Chinese coal mines. And it was generally admitted that this was an undercount because of all the wildcat coal mining, because there's a lot of places in North China where there's sort of a overburden of soil and then coal immediately underneath the ground. So people just dig pits and start digging out coal. But a lot of the time, the soil overburden would just collapse on top of them. and they would be killed that way. And, of course, there's all the other damage that comes with burning coal. There was an interesting documentary called The Iron Dome, which the People's Republic government tried very hard to suppress, about the just horrible air pollution problem coming with burning coal. Anyway, but I just want to leave you with the idea that anybody who says that using energy is bad and we ought to use less of it doesn't know what they're talking about, hasn't thought about what the implications are, what that would mean, and now is the Dubious Coals Committee with Tobe. Enjoy.
7, 6.